Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Harry Clark Azidio, policy correspondent at The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. In this episode, we're delving into the world of government contracts and the links between money awarded by the state to companies and interests linked to politicians and peers. From opaque contract awards to cozy relationships between politicians and business elites, the idea of a Trumpocracy has long been making headlines and raising eyebrows. But just how endemic is the issue, and how does it affect the functioning of the state? Joining me in the studio is Will Dunn, the New Statesman's business editor, who's been exploring the links between peers and politicians and the awarding of government money. Will, great to have you with us today.
Thanks, Harry.
So you covered this topic for the New Statesman cover story a few weeks ago, but before we get into that, you've uncovered an example of the close relationship between public representatives and government contracts. This concerns the Tory life peer and former minister, John Nash. You found that since 2013, companies Nash has an interest in have invoiced the government for over £3.8 billion worth of goods and services. Can you tell us a bit more about what you found?
So it's £3,836,812,340.02. That is the amount of money that the state has paid to companies in which Lord Nash has a financial interest. So there's no suggestion that he's done anything wrong in having a financial interest in those companies. But what it does show is that somebody in a particular position of power who also has a lot of diverse business interests, as Lord Nash does, he's a venture capitalist, invests in a lot of companies. But then that can lead to a situation in which, you know, that they leave themselves open to being potentially accused of a conflict of interest. And when the awards of money are so large, as they are in this case, I think it's worth asking if that is appropriate. So this is, you know, what we've been looking at is a little bit over 180,000 different, almost all contracts, but also some awards of money as in the form of grants, and separately some loans that were made to companies in which Nash is invested from bodies like the Future Fund, which was set up to keep startup companies going during the pandemic. And on the contract side, a lot of those go to one company called Softcat, which is a software company of which Lord Nash was formerly a director until 2013. And he now still has a very big stake in that company in terms of a very large shareholding. It's almost £90 million at today's share prices. If he's receiving the dividends that they're paying, and a stake of that size would have earned him about £2.24 million.
Wow.
So that's quite a lot of money to be making from companies that are making a lot of their money from the state. So when you put all that together in over a few years, it's worth asking, is this an appropriate thing for parliamentarians to be doing? Would it be sensible to have more transparency so that the public are more aware of, you know, the financial interests of parliamentarians who currently just have to declare a list of companies in which they own a stake over a certain value, but they don't have to say exactly how much, and they don't have to say things like, you know, where those companies get their money. Obviously, there are, you know, companies will want to protect their privacy, but the public has a right to know about the financial interests of the people they've elected.
Mm. It's worth saying again that from your reporting that there is no suggestion of any wrongdoing by Nash or any of the companies he's connected to. And as of this recording, he hasn't responded to a request for comment from the New Statesman. But I suppose the wider question is whether the current rules around the financial interests of MPs and those in the Lords and the awarding of state money and contracts are fit for purpose, especially when trust in politics is at such a vulnerable state at the minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's what we have in Britain is we use this phrase chumocracy sometimes, which describes the extent to which the state has been privatised, not just by the selling off of water companies and things like that, but also the extent to which government itself has been outsourced. There has been a very significant trend towards more of the things that government used to do in the past now being done by private companies, and a very significant increase in the spending involved on those companies. And I think the public have become increasingly suspicious of those processes. And in some cases, they are right to be. It's also the case that, in general, fraud as a crime has increased, you know, not necessarily by parliamentarians, but, you know, fraud now accounts for 40% of all crime. So this is also taking place within an environment of people increasingly expecting fraud to happen because it is happening more.
Mm. And as mentioned, you wrote a cover story for the New Statesman a few weeks ago titled "The Rotten State: How Corruption and Chumocracy Are Pulling Britain Apart." And since 2010, you note in your piece, the volume of government outsourcing has almost quadrupled from £64 billion a year to more than £220 billion. That's a very big slice of pie up for grabs. I mean, where did the roots of chumocracy, as you term it, stem from? Is this a relatively recent phenomenon, or does this actually date back under Blairism and the 90s even? I remember the Cash for Questions scandal was a particularly big one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, well, when I sort of went round Parliament for this feature, talking to a number of people, and, you know, some of the more senior MPs that I spoke to traced this back to the 1980s, to privatisation, to the change in the expectations of what government would do and what private companies would do in the operations of the state. But then once that had started, it took different forms. So through the Blair and Brown years, there were, there was outsourcing through PPE. There was a rise in the number of consultants used in government. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we do consultancy very well in this country. It's one of our biggest exports. It's, you know, but perhaps into government terms, it could be argued that we are doing a little bit too much of, you know, getting high off our own supply on consultancy terms, because and that's been recognised by the National Audit Office and within government, within the Cabinet Office. Actually, when the coalition came in, there was a movement towards reducing spend on consultants, which was successful for a while. But the government still wanted to be able to bring in people from the private sector who knew what they were doing, because the other side of it is that you have real problems with public procurement. And the best people at negotiating contracts and things like that, they always go to work for big companies rather than the government, because they'll pay a lot more. So the way to borrow some of their expertise is to bring them into government for, you know, some of their time. And often people are quite generous with their time for the, you know, to, because they want to help out, and, you know, because it's prestigious. And that's all good. But then that opens up all of these sort of, you know, extra areas that you need to scrutinise, because you are asking people who are not the government to do the government's work.
I mean, it's sort of not just exclusive to the government as well, though. I think if you look at the opposition, obviously Keir Starmer has, and his Labour Party have, sort of had really strong connections, whether that's more implicit or explicit, with the Tony Blair Institute, for example. So it's not something that is just limited to government, but it's, I suppose, in the context of the wider picture of just how our politics function.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and, you know, the Labour Party have been very sensibly making lots of overtures to the business community. I was at their business conference.
Got a nice lunch from what I
It was a very nice lunch. There was some, it was a lovely chicken thing. And
prawn cocktail, offensive, there, isn't it?
Was,
that's the term.
Yeah, it was. Well, the original prawn cocktail offensive was the Blair Brown charm offensive to the business community. And yeah, this, I think it's been called the smoked salmon offensive.
Smoked salmon,
I
that's
can't
it.
Remember yeah. if I saw any smoked salmon at the conference, but there was a nice falafel as well. Yeah, but that's very sensible for them to do that, because you do need to get businesses on side. You need to form relationships with businesses, because they will tell you a lot about what's going on in the economy that you might not get from civil servants. It's extremely sensible for any government to, or government in waiting, to have a proper dialogue with the business community. But it's also important to set boundaries and make sure that you concentrate on the transparency of those relationships.
Mm. The pandemic obviously was the event which really put the relationship between government ministers and associates of theirs into the spotlight when it came to procuring PPE, for example, for the NHS. Billions of pounds were also lost in support schemes set up to help businesses through the pandemic. Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, has promised to set up a COVID corruption commissioner to try and recoup some of the billions of pounds that were lost. This is something you address in the piece. Can you just sort of outline just how bad the scale of the fraud was, how bad the government were prepared to deal with it, and whether it's actually likely this ploy to recoup some of the money will actually be successful?
Well, if I start with the middle question first,
sure.
I think the reason that the COVID procurement went particularly badly was that the government was not prepared for a pandemic, and our government was not alone in that. But there were lots of very hasty meetings with companies, and that, you know, the government suddenly became an urgent buyer for things in markets where there were every other government in the world was also an urgent buyer for things. So that created a bit of a bonanza for some companies, I think it's fair to say. And I think that was really, you know, especially with things like, you know, the procurement of PPE, I think that created an opportunity for unscrupulous people to sell stuff to the government that was not quite up to scratch, as we've seen it in a number of cases. And I think the scale of that bad procurement, and then also at the same time, in order to keep the economy afloat, we were using a fiscal stimulus program that included furlough and loans to businesses. And those were also, because they were set up so quickly, they were also ripe for fraud. I think the most recent estimate is about, altogether, I think the most recent estimate is about 15.7 billion lost to sort of fraud and error around the COVID support programs, which is a lot of money. It's about 20 years of your library's budget. Yeah, and I think, you know, the public has seen that and decided that, you know, a lot of these hurried negotiations, things happening through VIP lanes, as they've been called, which structurally aren't necessarily a terrible idea. You know, that is a way in which the government buys things. It has things called framework agreements, where companies will be added to this agreement, which isn't so much saying, we're definitely going to buy this stuff from you. It's, you are one of this group of companies who...
You're a trusted sort of supplier
of these
things.
To buy things from. Yeah. And that was, in a way, the VIP lanes were a very, very quick and, in some cases, dirty way of doing that. And I say dirty, I mean, by dirty, I mean, a lot was just sort of done through text messages, you know, through private email accounts and things like that. There was a lot of less than transparent communication that didn't need to happen in that way.
Well, yeah, I suppose like one egregious example is the neighbour of the former Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, was awarded a contract supplying tens of millions of vials for NHS COVID-19 tests, despite having his company not having any previous experience of producing medical supplies, and he at first approached Matt Hancock with the idea by sending him a personal message on WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I suppose, a damning indictment of just, I suppose, the chaos of the procurement process.
And I think he later joked via WhatsApp that he would sort of say he'd never heard of Matt Hancock.
Nice.
Which is, yeah, doesn't look good. Yeah, I mean, you had people like the companies related to Douglas Barrowman and Michelle Moan that were given these very large contracts for PPE. Yeah, I think it's right that Labour should be proposing to look into a lot of these contracts and see where it might be possible to recoup some of that money, or, you know, whether or not it was fairly apportioned. In terms of doing that, I would be surprised if it's possible to get that much back, to be honest, because the numbers are very large. And, you know, a lot of these companies may have negotiated in good faith to the extent that they could at very high pressure times. So I would think that the more positive impact of having somebody in that office would be to set some clearer guidelines about what transparency requirements there should be in future.
Coming up after the break, how much are bad negotiations costing the government? If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all of our episodes ad-free on The New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
And one of the problems is the quality of negotiations that goes on between civil servants and private companies that provide services. I suppose it's difficult in a way because the sort of makeup and demographics of the civil service, there's a barrier, I suppose, to having negotiated in a context which they might have been able to get best value for money. There's perhaps not as many Del Boy types in the civil service as there is working for consultancy firms, for example. How does that sort of impact with the bloat of government spend on services?
Well, I think in a way it's probably fair to say that almost all procurement by the private sector as well as the public sector has a certain amount of bloat in it, in that especially when you're procuring really complex services, it's like IT services in particular, it almost always goes over budget and over time. I spoke for the article, I spoke to an academic called Bent Flivbjerg, who's at Oxford, who told me about the studies that he's done into the, you know, psychological and structural reasons why basically every single IT contract you look at ends up going over time and over budget. It's to do with people within organisations compete because they want their thing to get done. And because they want their thing to get done, they project optimistically about the results it will have and how cheap it will be to do. And so you have, and that's also true across, you know, across companies and the public sector. But then also in the public sector, you also have not just your department, you have the Treasury saying, right, you've got to make a business case for this. So in the case of something like HS2, you have the Treasury saying, right, you need to show that this will deliver a certain amount of economic impact. So that means you then, HS2 then have to come up with a business case that says, right, well, the economic impact will bring 200,000 people a day from London to Manchester.
Mm.
And then the engineers look at it and say, right, well, that means anything like a normal railway is just going to melt because you'll have to be running 1,000 trains an hour and they're all going to be made out of, you know, titanium. And so you have to sink all these enormous concrete piles into the ground for 100 miles. And I mean, that's slightly over-egging it a little bit, but you have to make something that is gold-plated, basically, in terms of how it's specified, which is loads more expensive, in order to justify the rather optimistic predictions that were made at the beginning of the process that everyone knew was never weren't really going to happen anyway.
Yes. But I think the ironic thing is with HS2 in particular, and there's been many headlines about how the cost of that has spiraled so much so that it's marginal as to whether it will actually benefit us in terms of the net spend and what it will then return in economic activity. But it seems as though, I suppose, it's almost baked into the way in which the government operates, in that you have green book logic that sort of dictates how money is spent by central government. And then on the other side, you have private companies trying to sort of overpromise and in a lot of cases underdeliver.
Yeah, and you also have something that Professor Flivbjerg pointed out to me. He said, you know, I asked him whether the UK was particularly different to other countries in this respect. And he said the way in which the UK is different is that we do something that is really expensive, which is we change our mind. And that HS2 is a particular example of that. When a government changes its mind about things, that's an incredibly expensive thing to do, even more than all the other money wasted. Because then everything has to be reassessed and replanned, and a new set of competing incentives comes in, and everything else gets re-gold-plated. And it's just a fantastic way of wasting money and time.
There is maybe not an explicit, but an implicit incentive to sort of overpromise, underdeliver, with the sort of expectation that there will be a bloat in a particular project, which could then in turn squeeze more money out of the government.
Yeah, I spoke to somebody who has a long experience of contracts with the public sector, being in the room while these contracts are being drawn up. And they told me that in a lot of cases, it's baked into the plan that, first of all, everybody will be lowballing. As in, they will be telling the contracting authority that they can do it, you know, more quickly and more cheaply than they know that they really can. And when the contract has been awarded, it's also to a certain extent written, this person claimed, to build up to what is apparently referred to in project management as an OFM or an OF. Moment. Don't know if we'll have to bleep that. And that's the moment where the engineers come along and say, oh no, we've found we have to tunnel through granite rather than sandstone. Oh dear. And that means it's going to cost a lot more money. This person claimed that it is absolutely routine for the people offering services to write contracts in their way, in the full expectation that they will have to kind of renegotiate at some point for more money, and that they don't really have any incentive to get things done on time and under budget. Why would they? It's creating more work is in their interest.
So like the status quo is to overpromise and like underdeliver, which kind of sounds like one of those terrible lines Lord Sugar wheels out during The Apprentice. But I suppose, you know, one of the big things we obsess with in our line is cut through and whether this actually resonates with the public. And obviously the procurement fiasco around the pandemic really did. But a recent poll released by the Anti-Corruption Coalition, politicians were the group that the public thought most likely to be associated with economic crime, mm-hmm. which isn't a great omen. Yeah. I mean, how much, I suppose, political resonance does this have, this perception of cronyism, of corruption in our politics?
Well, I mean, I think it's worth mentioning second on the list on that poll were, I think it was oligarchs and kleptocrats. Mm. Kleptocrats, obviously, by definition, are economic criminals. So, to a certain extent, what that poll reveals is that there's a certain section of society that doesn't know what the word kleptocrat means. Mm. but it also certainly does reveal that people have a really negative perception of the way in which politicians are able to separate their financial interests from the spending of the state. And in the UK, I think that is, despite what we've been talking about, we do have this kind of chumocracy problem. But I think, the UK is also, let's be realistic, a great deal cleaner than most other countries. I think were you to look at the way in which public spending is awarded in China or India, these are much bigger economies in the case of China, but there, I think there will be much more questions to ask. So we do have a robust system to a great extent, but I think there is a widespread feeling among the public that standards have slipped quite considerably. I think that's not a great thing for politics. It's also not a great thing for the economy, because one of the things that Britain trades on is our reputation for, you know, integrity, being a safe, stable place to do business. And if you have a fraying sense of integrity in among the public and politics, then that's not going to help the confidence of investors, whether they're foreign investors or domestic.
Integrity is the key word here, because, you know, Rishi Sunak, upon entering Downing Street after the fiasco of the Johnson administration, he promised integrity, professionalism and accountability. And obviously that the current status quo runs against that. When, I suppose, looking at what can be done about this, reform is the big question. Lobbying is obviously quite a key factor in how our politics functions. And the Lobbying Act that was introduced in 2014 is celebrating its 10th birthday this year. And there seems to be an appetite for reform. Is there any consensus about what that may look like or what that could constitute? Because clearly there is inefficiencies in the way the current system functions.
Just to ask, do you have a 10th birthday planned for the Lobbying Act? I mean, I know on the Spotlight team, you are serious policy nerds.
Yes. Well, that would be telling. It's not hit yet, as far as I'm aware.
It's on the list of legislative many birthdays.
Yeah, we're really cool.
To celebrate. So I think, you know, when you look at cases like David Cameron's lobbying on behalf of Greensill, financial company which has since, you know, gone into administration and is now being investigated by the Serious Fraud Office and is subject to a criminal investigation abroad. You know, he was using his personal contacts in government on behalf of Greensill, and you know, he was cleared by the regulator. He wasn't a politician at the time. You know, has returned as foreign secretary. He was, you know, been away from government for long enough that he wasn't a question for the ACABA regulator, but he wasn't sort of publicly declared as a lobbyist, so it wasn't happening in the most transparent way. But he was cleared by the lobbying regulator, as I believe was Owen Paterson, who was then suspended from Parliament following questions being asked about his work for the PPE supplier Randox.
Mm. And just finally, it's hard to put a monetary value on the cost of democracy, but I suppose the implications of a politics and a government that functions based on cronyism and corruption, that can have massive existential questions and a crisis for British politics to answer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people I spoke to for the piece was Dominic Grieve, who since leaving Westminster has been working as the chair of this new commission on governance and, you know, there's standards in public life. They've produced a report that has all sorts of recommendations about ways in which processes that could be tightened up. You'd love it on the Spotlight team. It's really wonky, but it's, you know, it's things like, you know, putting the House of Lords appointments on a statutory footing, taking that sort of privilege away from the Prime Minister to be able to appoint peers as they see fit, and things like that that would just help, firstly, probably with the process of government, but also help with the really serious problem of public perception. And that's the thing that, you know, ultimately, that Dominic Grieve said was the really big problem, aside from whatever the financial cost is in terms of, you know, what investors might think or how government works, it's the faith that people have in parliamentary democracy that matters.
Mm. A depressingly dour state of affairs, but very well explained. Thank you, Will.
My pleasure. Thank you, Harry.
Thanks so much for listening. You can read all of the pieces mentioned in this episode via the links in the show notes. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Harry Clark-Azidio, and my colleague, Will Dunn. Follow us on your podcast app to make sure you get new episodes as soon as they're released. You can watch video from this podcast on our YouTube channel. Just search YouTube for The New Statesman. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.